Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Phoebe Zimmerman reporting. U.S. television networks project Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as the winners in the southern state of Mississippi. For the Democrats, Clinton, the former Secretary of State, won big over her only rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders has been projected as the winner by a small margin of the second primary in Michigan. He urged Democratic voters to go to the polls for next week's continuing nominating contests.
Let us be prepared to tell the billionaire class they cannot have it all. Come out and vote next Tuesday. Thank you.
Trump, the real estate mogul, also beat his Republican challengers, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Ohio Governor John Kasich by a large margin. He also took the Michigan primary. Republican voters cast ballots in Mississippi, Michigan, and Idaho, and they caucus in Hawaii. The plain-speaking and often harsh Trump continues to be the top choice among Republicans over his rivals. Republican leaders have launched an intense effort to try to stop Trump, saying he's too unpredictable. Pentagon spokesman Peter Cook said a coalition strike Friday near the town of al-Shadadi targeted Tarkan Batirashvili, also known as Abu Omar al-Shishani, or Omar the Chechen. Cook said in a statement that at the time of the strike, Batirashvili had been sent to al-Shadadi to bolster ISIL fighters following a series of strategic defeats by local forces. A Defense Department official told VOA that as many as 12 Islamic State fighters were killed in the strike. This is VOA News. It was a bloody day in Tel Aviv Tuesday when a Palestinian stabbed an American tourist to death and wounded 12 Israelis while U.S. Vice President Joe Biden held talks just a few kilometers away. The State Department identified the dead American as Taylor Allen Force and called the attack that killed him senseless. The attacker was said to be from the occupied West Bank. Biden was meeting with former Israeli President Shimon Peres, who condemned Tuesday's violence. Iran said Tuesday it conducted ballistic missile tests at several sites across the country in order to show its deterrent power and readiness to confront threats. The Pentagon's Peter Cook said it plans to ask the United Nations Security Council to review Iran's latest tests and press for an appropriate response.
If these are in fact confirmed, the United States does plan to raise these issues at the UN Security Council. And again, it highlights a continuing issue that we would have with the Iranians. And again, this is an issue of concern to us.
The tests come 2 months after the United States imposed new sanctions against 5 Iranian nationals and a network of companies with links to banned missile activity. Political talks between the Syrian government and opposition are set to formally resume Wednesday, although key players will be absent. Jesse Shaheen is the spokeswoman for UN Syria envoy Staffan de Mistura.
The envoy will start substantive meetings with those who are in Geneva by latest the 14th of March in a staggered and proximity system of talks.
The UN said logistical arrangements have contributed to delays. In a statement to VOA, the main Syrian opposition group said it would be a no-show for the start of talks. Niger's opposition coalition announced Tuesday it is dropping out of this month's presidential election runoff, calling the entire system unfair. The Coalition for Political Change in Niger denounced the results of the first round, won by incumbent President Mahamadou Issoufou, as grotesque and cooked up. It says its candidate, Hama Amadou, will not participate in the second round on March 20th, but promised to keep working to keep Issoufou from winning another term. COPPA says Amadou is being unfairly deprived of his freedom in violation of international standards of free, fair, and democratic elections. Issoufou won last month's first round with 48% of the vote, but not enough to avoid a runoff. For more, visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Phoebe Zimmerman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, March 9th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Jacob Zuma continues his visit to Nigeria today, Wednesday.
President Zuma is in Nigeria for a three-day state visit at the invitation of the Nigerian president. And of course, the idea to strengthen the relationship between the two leading African economies.
Galba Shehu is the special assistant to President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. Somalia's government applauds a U.S. airstrike that killed about 150 Al-Shabaab militants. And a protest march today in Zimbabwe to commemorate 1 year since a pro-democracy activist went missing.
It's time for all youths to rise above partisan politics and indifference, because our future is certainly at stake.
Patson Zamora is the family representative for missing pro-democracy activist Itai Zamora. A new report says women wield too little political power globally. South Sudan says it is working to end child marriages. And a young South African musician gets praises for her fusion of tribal rhythms. Those stories plus Marco Uman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Jacob Zuma continues his three-day state visit to Nigeria today, Wednesday, at the invitation of President Muhammadu Buhari. The two countries are Africa's leading economies. Galba Shehu, special assistant to President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity, says President Zuma's visit is intended to strengthen the relationship between the two nations, especially at a time when Nigeria is trying to diversify its economy from a dependence on oil to agriculture and mining. The two nations are also discussing security cooperation. On Tuesday, President Buhari accused the South African mobile phone company MTN of fueling the Boko Haram insurgency by its failure to disconnect unregistered users. Garba Shehu says the MTN was negligent even after repeated warnings from the Nigerian government.
President Zuma is in Nigeria for a three-day state visit at the invitation of the Nigerian president. And of course, the idea to strengthen the relationship between the two leading African economies, Nigeria being top and South Africa being the second largest economy. There's so much here to learn from each other, especially now that Nigeria wants to move from over-dependence on oil, exploring possibilities in agriculture and mining. These are areas in which South Africa has achieved a lot of progress. We are discussing security, including arms manufacturing, and so on.
Your president, President Buhari, said on Tuesday that the South African mobile phone company, MTN, is helping Boko Haram. That's a heavy charge. Why did the president say that?
Well, I'm not sure he put it as clearly as he did. What he said is that they were slow in carrying out the registration of their own subscribers. And by default, that, of course, has led to the usage of telecoms platforms by just anyone, including terrorists. And he said the implication of that is that the action of the company may have aided the killing by Boko Haram of more than 10,000 Nigerians.
Shehu, this story is somewhat like what's happening here in the United States, where the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, is asking Apple company to unlock an iPhone that was used by the gentleman and his wife who carried out the mass shootings in California. And Apple is saying that this is privacy. If it does that, many cell phones bought by individuals may also be a threat from government.
Well, I don't think the cases are as you put them, because in the case of the Nigerian incident, it is very clearly stated that each company must profile and register all of their subscribers. And the law clearly states that if you fail to register within a given deadline, you must be surcharged so much money for each individual that you did not register. So it's a law and order situation. The MTN was negligent in this exercise. Even after repeated warnings and deadline extensions, they simply ignored ignored the government regulation.
Shehu, your government has fined MTN $3.9 billion for failing to disconnect these unregistered SIM cards. How is that going? Has the company paid?
No, they challenged the fine in court, and they on their own pulled the case out of the court, indicating their preparedness to sit down and negotiate. And the size of the fine, and I guess there was some remission of sorts. Testing had been cut by some percentage points because there's acceptance on their part. So they're talking to the government on how payment will be effected, and the government is on the table with them.
Garba Shehu is the special assistant to President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. He was speaking with me from Abuja. The Pentagon says a U.S. airstrike in central Somalia last Saturday killed more than 150 al-Shabaab militants who were preparing for a large-scale attack. Analysts say the strike was a major coup, but the African Union troops in Somalia still have a long fight ahead. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
In an interview with VOA, Somali presidential spokesman Dawood Awais applauded the airstrike. He says Somalia was aware of the strike and contributed intelligence.
We think that this was a significant victory not only for Somalia, but also for the entire region as we faced the same challenges in the war against terror. This was a coordinated attack in which Somali forces shared intelligence with their USA counterparts. These areas have been under close surveillance.
The training camp targeted is 190 kilometers north of Mogadishu. Pentagon spokesman Captain Jeff Davis said the U.S. had learned the fighters were set to depart the camp and pose an imminent threat to African Union forces and U.S. military advisors in Somalia. An al-Shabaab spokesman Abu Musab confirmed the aerial attack, but said the death toll was exaggerated. He says al-Shabaab does not gather more than 100 fighters in one place for security reasons. Analyst Yan St-Pierre, who runs the Berlin-based security firm Mossecon, says the opportunity for such a large strike may not come again.
Usually al-Shabaab, historically speaking, has always spread out its troops very well. So if this was indeed the case, that they had so many people in one location, it's a strategic mistake that they're definitely not bound to repeat.
Al-Shabaab has kept up a steady string of bombings against civilians in Mogadishu, while also going after African Union troops with renewed vigor since the middle of last year. On January 15th, al-Shabaab fighters stormed a Kenyan army camp in El Ade. In February, the Somali president said 200 soldiers lost their lives in that attack, a claim denied by the Kenyan government. Security observers say heavy losses in this and other recent raids are damaging the effectiveness and reputation of the African Union force, AMISOM. Analyst St-Pierre says airstrikes won't necessarily ease that pressure on ground troops.
Any American or Western support will be from the air, so they'll adjust their strategies accordingly while maintaining focus on the local troops. So the real message really needs to come from the AMISOM. It needs to come from the KDF. It needs to come from Somalia, much more than the Americans.
AMISOM has been fighting al-Shabaab in Somalia since 2007. The force currently has 22,000 men on the ground to provide assistance to the internationally recognized Somali government. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Today's Wednesday, March 9th. I'm James Botte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's Supreme Court on Tuesday granted permission to the family of missing pro-democracy activist Itai Zamara to hold a march today, Wednesday, to commemorate 1 year since the leader of Occupy Africa Unity Square was abducted by unknown assailants in Harare. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe program has details from the Zimbabwe capital.
The family approached the High Court after the police barred the planned march, arguing that it would infringe on other people's rights. Family lawyer Kenneth Masie told Studio 7 that Justice Clement Piri granted the order, saying it was the family's constitutional rights to demonstrate peacefully.
He cited that, in terms of the Constitution, in Section 59, there was an unfettered right that was given to the citizens of Zimbabwe to petition and demonstrate. And, the only qualification there was that the demonstration should be peaceful. So basically that's what he insinuated in this judgment.
Family representative Patson Zamara told journalists the commemorations are meant to send a message to the government that forced disappearance should not persist in Zimbabwe. He said Zimbabweans, especially young people, must take a stand and make sure that disappearance stop, as anyone can become a victim.
It's time for all youths to rise above partisan politics and indifference, because our future is certainly at stake.
He said people are expected to gather at Africa Unity Square and then march peacefully along Jason Moy to Rotten Row, Samora Machel, First Street, Nelson Mandela Avenue, and back to Africa Unity Square for prayers. Later in the day, a documentary and song to honor the missing activist, compiled by Patterson himself, will be unveiled at the Anglican Cathedral. Patterson Zamara said life without his brother has been very difficult, and the family is now struggling to cope, but remained hopeful that he would return one day.
Our emotions constantly oscillated between hope and despondence. Itai is still missing, and that is heart-rending.
Itai's wife, Shefra, said their two kids were equally worried and always asking about their father. Dick Frey, who worked with Itai Zamara in the Occupy Africa Unity Square project, said though work without the political activist had been very difficult, the group had re-strategized and was carrying on with his work. Itai Zamara Trust Chairperson Bishop Anselmo Magaya said it was disappointing that the government had failed to safeguard the life of Zimbabweans. He said developments in the ruling party indicate that no one is safe, and some of the people who have been part of the state-alleged atrocities have been isolated.
It is now clear that no one in this country, no matter what office they occupy, is safe. Nobody is safe.
Although the family secured a high court order compelling the police and other security services to update the family on their investigations, Patterson Zamara and the family lawyer Kenneth Masie said police had not provided any lead so far. Police spokesperson, Senior Assistant Commissioner Cherit Charamba, could not be reached for comment. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
As the world marked International Women's Day yesterday, Tuesday, a new report says women globally wield little political power, hampering efforts to bring about positive social and economic change for women. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the International Parliamentary Union launched its Women in Parliament 2015, the Year in Review report.
The report finds women's participation in parliament has plateaued. For the second year in a row, the Interparliamentary Union says women have put in a disappointing showing. Last year, it notes, the number of women members of parliament increased by a low 0.5% in 58 national elections to reach 22.6% of women in parliament globally. At this snail's pace, IPU Director of Programs Karin Jabr says women will not reach the 2030 target for equality as set out in the Sustainable Development Goals. In contrast, she says, more progress has been made concerning women parliamentary leaders, with nearly 18% of parliaments today being led by women speakers, including three newcomers.
Nepal, which is quite emblematic after the adoption of the constitution in the country, Namibia and UAE being the first country to have Arab country to have a woman Speaker of Parliament.
The report finds Latin America, with more than 27% of women in Parliament, has made the most progress, with sub-Saharan Africa not far behind. Though a number of elections in African countries were marred by violence and conflict, the IPU says women MPs have increased their numbers by 0.7% to reach 23.2%. Jabra says most progress has been made in Ethiopia and Tanzania due to quotas and other political incentives.
In Benin, we've noticed a very innovative campaign to encourage women, young women's political participation through social media. So this is also another interesting initiative that was noticed in Africa.
As in previous years, Rwanda has the highest proportion of female parliamentarians, with 65% of seats held by women. The IPU says overall, quotas remain one of the main tools for achieving progress in boosting the number of women MPs, but it adds quotas with teeth. It says sanctions must be applied and enforced where quota provisions are ignored. Otherwise, it warns, women will not be elected in large numbers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The government of South Sudan says it is working to end child marriages in the country. The Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Awud Deng Achul, says the government will enforce the age limit of 18 for marriage. Education Minister John Guy Yuao says his ministry is drafting a code of conduct which will impose a 7-year jail term for teachers who marry or impregnate underage girls. Gift Friday of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
Hundreds of South Sudanese women sing the song, "This is the day that the Lord has made," as they mark International Women's Day. The day began with a procession from Juba town to Nyokron Cultural Center. Government officials, soldiers, and schoolgirls joined in the procession. Zainab Yassin is the chairperson of South Sudan's General Women Association. Yassin says the theme was chosen to pass a message to the South Sudanese people that early marriage must end in the country. She is asking the National Minister of Education to create a platform for school administrators and parents to discuss the welfare of girls, especially the prevention of early child marriage. Speaking in Arabic, Yassin says girls from poor families are the most affected when it comes to child marriage.
During our time when we were young, the Ministry of Education made special considerations to children of farmers, children of widows, children of poor people, and children of soldiers. We need their children to study.
Edmund Yakani, the executive director of Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, which represents civil society organizations, is urging South Sudanese teachers to protect rather than abuse schoolgirls. Yakani says the state governments should adopt the girls' education bills. The chairperson of Specialized Committee for Gender in the National Assembly, Lydia Jock, says high poverty, traditional beliefs, conflict, instability, the low level of literacy, and gender gaps in education are all reasons for the rate of child marriage across South Sudan and other parts of Africa. She says many families marry off their daughters due to poverty. Jock describes this as a violation of girls' rights, which she says must end in order to ensure a brighter future for South Sudanese girls.
We must fight child marriage in South Sudan to bring it to an end by setting clearly a minimum age for marriage.
South Sudan's Education Minister, Dr. John Guy, agrees with the Yakani that teachers are often responsible for the high dropout rate of girls in South Sudan. He says there's punitive punishment for people who abuse girls in schools. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Juba.
A young South African musician is winning accolades for her fusion of tribal rhythms from around the world. Courtney Gibson blends Western instruments like the electric guitar with traditional African instruments like the djembe drum and other indigenous instruments to create exceptional sounds. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Gibson says she uses instruments like the didgeridoo to mimic the sounds of Africa's animals, like the slow, violent growl of a lion on a nighttime hunt.
I try and pull those sounds into the didge, and the drums obviously help a lot because drums is part of Africa. The beat has got the rhythm of Africa and everything that we are.
Her love of Africa, its nature and its people, was inspired by her upbringing on a farm in the mountains of Mpumalanga province. Here, villagers taught her to make music using waste materials from a local dump.
I kind of picked up a pool pipe and started playing a pool pipe because I didn't have money for a didgeridoo, as us South Africans don't much have money, so.
As a child with pool pipe in mouth, Gibson dreamed of one day owning a real didgeridoo.
I just liked the sound, always liked the sound. I always found it had a nice tribal feel to it.
As Gibson has grown as a musician, so has her small collection of instruments, helping her create some of South Africa's most unique contemporary music.
Na, 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 na.
Gibson says no matter what she ever achieves as an artist, she'll never come close to her hero, the great South African folk singer and songwriter, Vusi Mahlasela.
Let's take this speed and put it right inside of this evil monster so we can learn to be free.
She recently saw Mahlasela at a festival and approached him with a request.
Can I please play you a song? And he was kind of a bit shocked. He just said, okay, play it. And I played on his guitar. And it was the most amazing thing. Gave me a big hug afterwards.
Like Mahlasela, Gibson makes music with a conscience. While most white South African musicians try to sound like American and British indie rock bands, Gibson's art remains firmly rooted in the bush of Mpumalanga.
I don't see why I should be something that I'm not. I'm African, I'm born here. My soul and everything inside me is African.
Many of her songs reflect her concern about the destruction of Africa's environment. Gibson says she doesn't want to be famous. She knows she'll never win awards playing what she calls her weird music. All that matters, she says, is that she's true to herself, true to Africa, and true to the rhythms alive inside her. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with wrestling. Hosts Egypt bagged 9 gold, 6 silver and 7 bronze medals to top the overall medal table at the Africa Wrestling Championships, which ended in Alexandria on Monday. Tunisia is second ahead of Nigeria. Algeria is fourth, followed by Senegal, Cameroon, Guinea-Bissau, South Africa, Morocco, Namibia, and Chad. Tunisia prevailed in the men's freestyle wrestling, with Egypt second ahead of Nigeria, while Nigeria carried the day in the women's freestyle wrestling, with Tunisia second ahead of Egypt. Egypt dominated the Greco-Roman event. Algeria were runners-up, and Morocco placed third. Meanwhile, the East Africa Secondary School Sports Association Games President Justus Mugisha confirmed to the media in Kampala, Uganda on Monday that this year's regional sports event will be staged in Eldoret in Western Kenya. The week-long event, which features teams from Burundi, Rwanda, South Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, Zanzibar and hosts Kenya, will start on the 26th of August. Turning to football, disgraced former FIFA Vice President Michel Platini has filed an appeal with the Court of Arbitration for Sports against FIFA's six-year ban from all football activities, the Court of Arbitration for Sports revealed in Lausanne, Switzerland. According to FIFA's Ethics Committee and FIFA's Appeals Committee, Platini and former FIFA President Sepp Blatter attracted the sanction following a breach of the FIFA Code of Ethics. Finally, hosts Togo pipped Ghana by a solitary goal in a friendly match played in Lome over the weekend. Both sides fielded teams composed of home-based players. Both teams are preparing for the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers later this month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Niger's opposition coalition announced Tuesday that it is dropping out of this month's presidential election runoff, calling the entire system unfair. The Coalition for Political Change in Niger, known as COPA, denounced the results of the first round, won by incumbent President Mahamadou Issoufou, as grotesque and cooked up. It says its candidate, Amadou, will not participate in the second round on March 20th. That's it for this Wednesday, March 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, I'm James Butty in Washington saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC. next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.